The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Martha Potter from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State Magazine. Today's reading of Our State Magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting this podcast for over 15 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. Today we'll continue with the remaining articles of Hidden History, which is the secondary theme for April, and explores little things that shape our state. The first article up is The Survival Game. In Burke County, an ancient sport tied to the Italian immigrants who founded the town of Valdese may be the key to keeping a culture's traditions in play. The first of three bocce ball courts tilts to the right, Dr. John Lafferty explains, and knowing this should influence how you roll your ball. Not that the good doctor and his fellow players inform opposing teams of this tilt. No, Lafferty and his gaggle of teammates shout in unison, all gray of hair and fierce of spirit. Tilts and other such vagaries are for bocce teams to discover on their own. Competitive fire may be wired into all sports, but it's a tad surprising to see among this particular group of athletes in the foothills village of Valdese. Here the ancient game of bocce ball is intimately entwined with peace-loving religious community known as the Waldensians, originally hailing from northern Italy. The group's three-court bocce shed is located behind a men's club founded in 1909. Impressively, the club's formal name is L'Affaire des Alpes, LPDA for short, which in the Waldensian's French-Italian patois means Lighthouse of the Alps. Waldensian immigrants settled in this area in 1893 and responsible for many of Valdese's institution. Dominating downtown Ambling Main Street is the Gothic-style Waldensian Presbyterian Church, which features a bocce court right next to its babbling fountain. You don't have to be Waldensian to partake in bocce ball, but it's unlikely that you'll play the game here and not rub shoulders with a member of the community. But some fear that Waldensian traditions are fading. In recent years, active membership at LPDA dipped so much that attaining a quorum to tend to club business was a feat. The numbers are better now, but the percentage of members who are Waldensian has sunk from about 80 a few years ago to more like 60 or 70 today. That's okay with ponytailed 73-year-old club stalwart Rob Murray, as long as people of any persuasion keep showing interest. What we're saying is, come, we'll teach you the game, Murray says. It's easy, you can hold a glass of wine and play. Murray, one of the town's leading ambassadors of bocce, is as sly as a fox reigning over his patch of forest. A wink seems attached to everything he says, but make no mistake, he's serious about this game. Like the visiting teams forced to puzzle through the peculiarities of each bocce court, Murray and his fellow Waldensians have been busy figuring out how to keep their centuries-old tradition in play. The town of Valdese perches just off Warring State Interstate 40 between Hickory and Morganton, but its story starts in a place and a time far, far away. In the 12th century, long before the revolution of Martin Luther, a French merchant by the name of Peter Waldo seized on the Bible's call to live humbly and help others. Renouncing wealth, Waldo and his followers disavowed the hierarchies that ruled the Middle Ages, preaching as lay people, condemning papal excess, and rejecting Catholic dogmas like purgatory and transubstantiation. Not surprisingly, the powers that be came down hard with campaigns of persecution. Early Waldensians fled to remote valleys in the Italian Alps. Eventually, they left their crowded villages to establish new communities abroad, from South America to the Old North State. Accustomed to jagged terrains, the North Carolina contingent liked the look of the foothills, where they established a settlement in 1893 and took to farming. But farming didn't take to the Waldensians, what with the region's unforgiving ground. This land is rock, Murray grumbles. You can garden and garden and garden, but every year there's more rock. I don't know where it all comes from. Never ones to fold easily, the Waldensians plowed into other trades, opening a series of textile mills and a bakery. For decades, kids clambered around the bakery asking for scraps like broken cookies, all free, first come, first served. The Waldensian mills eventually closed. The bakery is now in corporate hands, but cultural history endures in the life-size outdoor displays dotting the town's Waldensian Trail of Faith, the elaborate exhibits in the Waldensian Heritage Museum, and a series of murals on Main Street. Growing up, the heritage was such a big part of my life, Amy Melton says. The perseverance of the Waldensian people, it gave me a sense of pride. After living in New Bern for a while, Melton, now 44, returned to Valdez with a family of her own. Kids now have a hard time finding their place and knowing who they are, she says. I want my girls to have that sense of heritage. Inside Highlands Butchery, Alex Garrison, bearded and wearing a baseball cap, passes a plate that explains bocce ball's appeal. Essentially, it's a shuffleboard meets bowling game, he says. Pressing a napkin to her face, his wife, Tamika, counters, no, she says, it's like bowling and horseshoes. The bantering twosome are gathered with their sons, detailing life in Valdez over traditional Waldensian meal of sutiso sausage and potatoes with a tangy salad and a hard roll. The butcher described sutiso as a Christmas in a casing. More precisely, it's pork laced with nutmeg, allspice, garlic, pepper, and other seasonings that no properly proprietary Waldensian chef will verify. But back to bocce. Descriptions vary, as do spellings. It could be bocce, B-O-C-C-E, or bocce, B-O-C-C-I-E, or bocce, with B-O-C-C-I, with the preferred pronunciation being bacha. And there's no telling what they call the game in ancient Egypt, where evidence suggests it was trending back as far as 5,200 B.C. The earliest incarnations may have involved rocks and coconuts, but the Italian version, passed down from the Roman Empire, is what the Waldensians brought here. It's played on narrow, sand and clay-packed courts, about 50 to 75 feet long, outlined by 6-inch-high walls. Two teams of four or more complete to pitch, more like roll, wooden or plastic handballs closest to a smaller target ball called a polino, or in Waldensian patois, a bouchin, B-O-U-C-H-I-N. The Garrisons take a portable version of bocce ball on vacations with them, eager to explain the history of the sport to curious onlookers. They've lately been delighted to see the game popping up as brew pub recreation as far beyond Valdez, but there's nothing quite like the hometown experience. One afternoon, Rob Murray's squad of bocce aces raucously coaches a newcomer as a player's granddaughter skips about nearby, flaunting dinosaur finger puppets. There's no wine out today, although 79-year-old Dennis Barris, reputed to be the best player in town, notes that it's been used before as aiming fluid. Murray remembers the old days of bocce ball in Valdez when it was strictly a men's game. Back then, the matches could be spicier than a sutiso sausage. It was a bunch of guys standing around drinking wine and cursing in patois, he said. As a kid, Murray would watch excitedly, wanting to get in on the game, but finding himself shooed away. Other kids steered clear of the courts, having been sternly warned off by their mothers. The exclusivity eventually took its toll in bocce. Bocce went nearly belly up in Valdez. In the early 60s, fewer young men were learning about the game. That's when town elders got serious about renewing the community's sense of heritage and its pride in the game. Now, says Gretchen Kostner, executive director of the 50-year-old Waldensian Heritage Museum, we're eager to tell everyone about bocce, women and children included. The town's primary courts have evolved from clearings in a pine forest to three well-groomed sand and clay lanes behind the one-room LPDA clubhouse two blocks off Main Street. The game's pretty simplistic, Murray says, but it's also like chess in its strategy. You get better by working on your accuracy and speed. Soon, new terms and tricks are flying around as fast as bullets. Techniques for rolling the handball. When to risk the hard, aggressive toss known as a raffle, pronounced riffle. How to bank a ball off the border wards. The club now hosts out-of-town teams for tournaments and less formal matchups. Sometimes everybody's laughing their heads off, says 69-year-old Barry Remington, renowned for the curve on his pitches. Sometimes you can cut the tension with a knife. That isn't surprising, considering that the stakes of the game go far beyond any individual bout. The Waldensians are playing for the preservation of a culture that survived the worst that the Middle Ages and Renaissance could throw at it, and that now navigates the wiles of modern times. This is all about heritage, Murray says. That's why I'm around, to make sure that it's here for someone else down the line. For more information on the Waldensian Heritage Museum, visit WaldensianHeritageMuseum.com. I'll take you through a couple of the photos in this article. Bocce ball aces, Steve Martinet, Rob Murray, and Barry Remington hope to attract younger players in Valdez, where the ancient game is a Waldensian tradition. And we have a downward-looking shot on this sort of sand and dirt plot of the court, and the plastic balls that they use to throw, along with the small ball that they're trying to aim for. And the other picture on the facing page shows these gentlemen playing bocce ball. They're all on the outside of the court, and the one who's throwing his ball is on the inside of the court. The heart of bocce culture in Valdez can be found at the Waldensian Presbyterian Church in downtown. There you might even find Murray practicing on the court next to the sanctuary. And it shows there's a brick walkway and a brick fence, brick and wood fence, with a big banner, a history of bocce. And the picture of the church was a very simple structure, not very ornate. It looks actually very Italian in its look, with surrounded by a stone wall and some evergreen trees. And displays inside the Waldensian Heritage Museum trace Valdez's teams back to the late 19th century. One of the town's earliest bocce courts was located in the lot next to the present-day City Hall. And they have some, looks like, I guess these are outfits that they would wear, Valdez textiles. And La Fer des Alpes. And then there's a very old picture from 1916 where they're just playing in a flat area in a grove of pine trees, it looks like. After a day on the bocce court, Valdez residents may sit down to a traditional Waldensian meal of sotiso sausage and potatoes in restaurants like Highlands Butchery, a local restaurant there. And that's it's served in a bowl, and the sausage is cut up, and then there's potatoes underneath the sausage, it looks like. Looks pretty tasty. The next article is entitled Lost in the Trees. Long before the last family departed, settlers in a remote corner of Yancey County gave their mountain town the name Lost Cove. Years later, the choice seems prophetic. The once thriving community has returned to nature, tucked out of sight, lost to all except historians and hikers. The forest is swallowing up the old town, nature's demolition crew. Vines grow from the windows of two dilapidated homes. A lone chimney made of rocks rises from a hill next to the rusting shell of a 1938 pickup truck, now spattered with gripe-ring moss. A stone wall runs parallel to the narrow footpath that leads from the once-busy southern part of town to a small cemetery up the northern edge, where gravestones reveal names like Tipton, Bailey, and Miller. Lost Cove is dead now, gone for more than six decades. The only evidence of human activity decomposing, rusting away, and scattered across 350 acres of dense forest high above the Nolichucky River in Yancey County, where North Carolina meets Tennessee. When our hiking party arrives here after a two-hour adventure descending the steep and rocky switchbacks that zigzag down the north face of Flattop Mountain near Burnsville, the sky opens up and rain pours down on us. Our guides, Appalachian historian and avid hiker Christy Smith and her partner Thomas Glenn, lead us to a small clearing where Lost Cove's most prominent surviving home sits next to the remnants of a makeshift campfire held together by what looks like old parts of an old backhoe. At one time, Chester Bailey's family lived here, Christy says, reaching for the hood of her jacket and pulling it over her knit ski cap to provide a little shelter from the storm. But multiple families lived here at different times over the years, she points down the footpath. You had Millers living over that way, toward the school, she says, and over there, she pivots and points in the opposite direction, you had the Tiptons and the Bryants. The individual families of Lost Cove lived in clusters, Christy explains, but they were all one community, she says, one very hard-working, resourceful, and self-sufficient community. Christy was 10 years old the first time she hiked into Lost Cove. Her mother, Emma, a nurse with the Unicoi County Health Department just across the state line in Irwin, worked with a woman whose relatives had lived in the community decades earlier. One day in 1982, the two decided to take their families on a day hike into the ghost town. Setting off from Unaka Springs on the Tennessee side of Carolina, Clinchfield and Ohio, CNO rail tracks, the group of about 10 made the 3.5-mile trek up the steep mountain terrain into North Carolina as locomotives rumbled by every half hour or so. You had to be extra cautious because in some places there's hardly any space to get off the track, Christy recalls. I remember hugging a rock at one point. It was a little exciting. So exciting that Christy got hooked on hiking into the cove and exploring the abandoned houses. Just the beauty of walking in that gorge with the Nolichucky River roaring next to you, she remembers. I loved it. And then, when you got to the top, there was this little community, but there were no people. Back then, she says, several more structures were still standing. There was a house down by the railroad tracks near the spot where Lost Cove's post office once sat. There was the Frank Bryant house and some of the homes that Bailey's lived in near the cemetery, and there were three or four homes lining the hill where the old pickup truck now sits. The houses even had furniture in them and pots and pans, Christy says incredulously, and that's because these people had thought they'd always be coming back one day. They never intended to leave forever. Those houses were just sitting there waiting for the families to return. Christy began asking questions about Lost Cove. As it turned out, she had an indirect family connection to the town. Her grandfather, Bob Johnson, an engineer for CNO Railway, regaled her with stories about how his father, who also drove a steam engine, would stop over in Lost Cove to buy moonshine. By high school, Christy was deep in her study of mountain folkways, writing poems about her Appalachian heritage and getting published in anthologies like those compiled by Sparrowgrass Poetry Forum. After graduation, she set off for East Tennessee State University, where she studied English with a focus on Appalachian history and folklore. From her master's thesis in 2007, she wrote about the people of Lost Cove, then spent nearly 15 years expanding her research into a book, Lost Cove, North Carolina, Portrait of a Vanished Appalachian Community, 1864 to 1957. Here's what Christy has learned over the past three decades. Lost Cove was founded during the Civil War years by a Union soldier, Stephen Morgan Bailey, who likely set up camp in this remote area to avoid the awful conflict that was dividing his family and friends back home in Burnsville. At that time in the Appalachians, a lot of men were Union, so you had brother fighting against brother and neighbor fighting against neighbor, Christy says. But up in Lost Cove, almost everyone was Union. There was one guy who was a Confederate, but the interesting thing I found about during my research was that later he switched to Union as well. Bailey was joined by John D. Tipton, a Union soldier with the 3rd North Carolina Mounted Infantry, who bought 230 acres. The growing community named their town Lost Cove, presumably because at that time it was unclear whether the land was in North Carolina or Tennessee. During the town's first decades, its inhabitants had limited contact with the outside world, mostly relying on each other for survival. An abundance of spring water made the land fertile for farming. To feed themselves, the families raised hogs, chickens, and cows, and grew corn, potatoes, tomatoes, cucumbers, green beans, and herbs. Apple orchards blanket the outskirts of the settlement, surrounded by tall oak, pine, poplar, and ash trees. For items not produced in the community, like housewares, kerosene oil, coffee, and molasses, the families used a sled to haul their crops east to the town of Poplar, where they bartered for these goods and brought them back home. The community's first church, Tipton's Chapel, was built around 1880. 29 years later, its name was changed to Lost Cove Free Will Baptist Church, and later changed again to Mountain View. Walking along the footpath toward a second decaying home, Christie points to a set of moss-covered concrete steps next to the trail. "Those were the steps leading into the sanctuary," she says. "The church was the center of social life in Lost Cove, serving as both the house of worship and the town's school building." By the early 1900s, the railroad was completed down by the river, and Lost Cove resident Mac English built a sawmill that employed most of the men in the community. By the 20s and 30s, the old paths, once used by people, only by people and horses, accommodated a truck or two, which were brought in to haul wood and other items. Many of the women in the community made hook rugs from socks or burlap sacks. The prevalence of so many springs in Lost Cove, as well as its location in the disputed territory between the two states, made it a perfect setting for moonshine stills, as revenue agents and the judicial system couldn't figure out which state had jurisdiction. And make moonshine the townspeople did. For the next half century, families in Lost Cove were known for brewing up some of the finest hooch in western North Carolina and eastern Tennessee, and they often sold it to passing C&O railway workers like Christie's grandfather. Members of John Tipton's family were the biggest bootleggers in Lost Cove, Christie says, but every family made moonshine. They all had stills. And moonshining became particularly important during the Depression years. They relied on it during that period. In its entire history, from about 1865 to 1957, Lost Cove never had electricity, so residents read by kerosene lamps at night and stored perishable goods like milk and butter in holes dug next to the springs. During the town's most prosperous years of the early to mid-20th century, about 100 people lived in 13 to 15 homes. There were big barns, corn cribs, apple sheds, and even a commissary where residents could buy snuff, sugar, and other goods. Lost Cove was jumping. By the 1950s, though, the modern world had begun to encroach. Freight trains on the C&O lines replaced the passenger trains that Lost Cove residents had come to rely on for trips to nearby communities. The supply of timber had been depleted, leaving residents with few ways to earn a living. When Yancey County began consolidating its small mountain schools, students were forced to leave Lost Cove for their studies. It was just too tough to live in the town anymore. And some people began relocating to nearby Burnsville and Irwin. By 1957, only three families remained. On New Year's Day, 1958, Velmer Bailey's family became the last to leave Lost Cove. By then, the town was utterly quiet, no children laughing and playing, no sounds of saws and falling timber, only the lone whistle of the occasional freight train rolling by on the tracks down by the Nolichucky River. On the wall behind the pulpit of the church, Bailey wrote the words, "School closed forever at Lost Cove, December 17, 1957. Last revival conducted by Clyde Fender, November 1956. Last Sunday school, November 26, 1957. Very sad." 4 months later, he told the Johnson City Press Chronicle, "We don't want to leave, but we have no choice. Others have left, and we can't stay here alone." The rain had slowed to a trickle by the time we began our ascent back up the flat-top mountain. If the hike down seemed precarious, the trek back up feels almost impossible. We're soaked, exhausted, out of food, nearly out of water, and feeling a little melancholy, knowing that the people of Lost Cove never wanted to leave their remote town, and they always hoped to one day return. Christy looks over her shoulder and sighs. At some point, you know, nature's going to totally reclaim every bit of this, she says. I know that. We all know that. She points back at the Chester Bailey house, at the graffiti covering the siding and the interior walls. She has mixed feelings about hikers coming here. On one hand, she thinks that people should experience the old ghost town to understand how mountain people lived, beyond the stereotypes depicted in books and movies and TV shows. On the other, she feels this is sacred ground that should be treated with reverence. So it's kind of like a catch-22 for me, she says. I would love for people to be able to come to visit Lost Cove and see all this history. But some people just don't have respect for the land or the community. And it's important that this place be treated with respect. Now I'll go back to some of the pictures that were mentioned, that were in this article. Lost Cove was remote even in its heyday when it was home to the Miller family and others. Now a challenging hike through Pisgah National Forest is the only way in and out. And they have a drone photograph of looking down on the roof of the one house that was mentioned in the article that's still somewhat standing. There's a picture of a chimney, just a chimney standing. It's interesting that the top of the chimney is brick and the lower part of the chimney is all stone that's stacked. There's a picture of the decaying old truck that was mentioned in the article is on one page. And there's a picture of the, it looks like a little shack, a little home, and then there's a picture of an older, in its current state today of decay, and the a picture older when it was in newer condition. The local Free Will Baptist Church was once central to life in Lost Cove. Now all that remains of the old chapel is a set of concrete steps, carpeted with moss. And we see an old picture of the very, very simple church, no windows. It's just a white structure with a steeple. And then the steps that remain only. And in a picturesque neighborhood that's an easy walk from the Burnsville Town Square is a stately two-story home built in the early 1900s as part of the private Stanley McCormick School. In the mornings, you'll find Sue Frost and her husband Michael in the kitchen preparing breakfast for visitors who are in town to peruse the abundance of law art studios or explore Lost Cove and other hiking areas that stretch across the wilds of Yancey County. The Frosts, who bought the Terrell House Bed and Breakfast in 2022, say they're just carrying on a tradition begun by the original owners, Pat and John Terrell. Well, we've run out of time for this time for today's episode of Our State Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and that you'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Martha Potter, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-831-1973.